Good morning. Welcome to Brookings, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ömer Taşpınar. I'm the director of the Turkey program. It's a great honor this morning to host my good friend Hugh Pope. And Hugh is in town for his latest book, Dining with Al-Qaeda, Three Decades Exploring the Many Worlds of the Middle East. And we're delighted that he's here. He's giving many talks about his book. We're not here for his book, but I'm sure he'll be also delighted to answer questions if you have about the Middle East. The topic of our talk today is Turkey-EU with a special focus on Cyprus. And Hugh is the right person to address such an important topic. And I'm glad we managed to have a decent crowd who are still interested in Cyprus and Turkey-EU, despite all the other attractions surrounding Turkey these days. And Hugh, as I said, is the right person to address this, not only because he's an excellent journalist, but he's also a very strong analyst. He's currently the project director with the International Crisis Group focusing on Turkey, EU-Cyprus. We joked that he was in charge of the reunification of the island in the International Crisis Group, something that we've been waiting for decades. But most importantly, Hugh, you see his short bio here. He's the author of many books. In addition to his current book on the Middle East, Dining Al-Qaeda, he is the acclaimed author of two important books on Turkey and the Turkey world, Turkey Unveiled, which I proudly use in my Turkey course board at SAIS and National Defense University.
Probably in photocopies, right?
No. And the other book on Turkey is Sons of the Conquerors, and that's more about Central Asia and the roots of Turkey and looking also at basically the larger Turkic world. We're delighted to have Hugh with us this morning, and just one administrative note, we will end at 11:30 instead of noon, and Hugh will talk about for 30 minutes, and then we'll open this to a Q&A. So Hugh, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much, Ömer. Thanks to Brookings Institution for having me here to talk about my pet subject. Not many people like talking about Cyprus, and it's a fascinating topic, and there is hope there, and hope of movement. But I'd like to, first of all, set the stage a bit widely. Ömer was telling me that this audience is not really engaged with the Cyprus question for a couple of years, so I'll start by talking a little about Turkey and Europe and why it's an important issue, and then I'll talk about the importance of Cyprus, which is a rather small island of 1 million people, after all, and why should we care? And then I'll tell you a little bit about what's happened in the talks for the last couple of years and why I think there is something to hope for there. Now, Turkey, of course, is something of a sui generis country. It's very hard to put it in a block. Is it in Europe? Is it in the Middle East? Is it a Eurasian country? Is it part of the Islamic world? It's something that, as a journalist, I had to deal with the whole time. And there is no easy answer to it. It doesn't fit into any prepackaged format, and I think one should always start by realizing that. But within those constraints, Turkey is an embedded member of the West and Europe. And I think if you look institutionally, Turkey has, since the 1950s, steadily knitted more and more links with the West. It joined NATO. It's a member of nearly every European organization, from the Council of Europe to the European Song Contest to the European Football League, and currently Istanbul is a European capital of culture. This is not a small matter. And it's actually negotiating, obviously, to be a full member of the EU, and that is a process that is deeply affected by Cyprus, as I'll come to in a moment. The relationship with Europe, however, has always been problematic and beset by prejudices on both sides. And in fact, Turkey and the European Union have been negotiating one way or the other for more than 60 years. A lot of the time, it's been a bit of a game, frankly. like the old joke about the Soviet Union, adapted for Turkey and the EU, would run, Turkey pretends to join the EU, and the EU pretends to accept Turkey. And that was an extraordinarily clever piece of constructive ambiguity. It allowed both to continue with their respective projects while benefiting without having to commit completely. Now, that has changed in the last few years. And what changed was the actual advent of real negotiations to join the EU in 2005. At that point, people in Europe got scared. And they got scared for all the wrong reasons, and politicians picked up on it very quickly, especially in France and Germany, and we've seen it come and go in various other countries as well, like Austria, the Netherlands, Denmark. And what happens is that there's a false logic, and the European side, the European public thinks, oh my God, look, there's 70 million people, they're much poorer than we are, and they all want to come, plus they're Muslims, and I don't understand Muslims, and I'm frightened of Islam, and I'm frightened of immigrants, and I'm frightened about my job. And politicians in Europe are looking for re-election in the short term. They're not looking at the fact that the EU membership of Turkey is at least a decade away. And by the way, I've lived in Turkey for 23 years, and it's always been a decade away, as long as I can remember. And I make something of a hobby of talking to Turkish leaders and asking them, okay, it's 2025, you've fulfilled all the criteria, everything's going well, the French president sent his plane, and they're coming with the treaties of Nice, Rome, Maastricht, everything else, and you're going to sign and put Turkey fully in the European Union. Would you sign? I still haven't met a Turkish leader who says, yes, I would sign. They almost always say, when that happens, we'll see. Because for most people in the Turkish elite, the European convergence process is a process, not a goal. The process is a goal in itself. There's not much thinking about the actual joining. That however, is changing, as I would like to point out, because what happened when these politicians like Nicolas Sarkozy and Angela Merkel, and there are others too in other countries, have used the EU-Turkey process as a way of getting votes from scared populations. And in France, it's particularly unpleasant, because what actually happens is that when Sarkozy attacks the EU-Turkey process, he's actually raising the image of Arabs and Muslims in French minds quite inappropriately, because in France, at a popular level, there's not much distinction between Turks, Arabs, and Muslims. But you can't use Arabs and Muslims that way in the public debate. And he manages to use Turkey as a proxy for that and get votes from the National Front. So what's happened then with someone like Sarkozy taking on this role of attacking the EU-Turkey process, it has politicized the process in Europe, which is a very interesting thing. So whereas in the old days, the left wing in Europe used to attack Turkey on human rights basis, on its authoritarian habits and so forth, now, when they see Sarkozy attacking the EU-Turkey process, they think, well, hang on, Sarkozy's attacking it, we should support it. So now there's an interesting dynamic, and a very new dynamic in Turkey, that you have Europeans speaking up for Turkey in domestic debates. My Swedish friends, for instance, will look at Turkey and say, hang on, we as Europe, with about 500 million people, we can't stand up in the future against China, India, Russia. We need more people. We need these Turks with us. We need London as our bookend in the West, and Istanbul as our bookend in the East. They see the bigger picture. But that's, I have to say, still an elite perspective in Europe, but it's one that I hear quite a lot. And given the fact that Europe is in such confusion at the moment, there is these elites are feeling more and more the need to speak up about the need to have a more pan-European ideology. And perhaps that's a hope for the future. And I would also point out another change in Europe that's happened despite the difficulties of the last 4 or 5 years with Europe, is that the city of Istanbul has become a completely normal place to go, a city break weekend destination for middle-class rich people in Copenhagen, Stockholm, Paris, London. And the streets outside my house on Istiklal Street have never been so full with expensive-looking foreigners. And another interesting part of that is it's very difficult to tell now who is the foreigner and who is the Istanbuliot. Istanbul has become a regional center, even perhaps an international hub, and it is changing the way Istanbul is perceived. And I think that if you ask most Europeans, is Istanbul part of Europe, they would say yes. And if you ask Eurostat, the official EU agency for this kind of thing, Istanbul is in fact the biggest city in Europe. And by the way, there are two other Turkish cities in the top 10 biggest cities of Europe, to give you a flavor of how things are. There's also been a change in the debate in Turkey. Seeing this rather insulting language from Europe, and remember that Turkey over the Europe over the decades has promised to negotiate in good faith with Turkey about its membership, to see Merkel and Sarkozy basically taking away their country's commitment to that solemn obligation, has made people quite bitter. And I think when you see some of that rather extravagant, flamboyant rhetoric from AKP leaders, particularly the Prime Minister, that appear to be supporting hardline figures in the Middle East or attacking the West, it is a reaction to that sense of being pushed away. It's, hang on, look at me, I'm important too, is part of it. But I think that you should also be aware that the Turkish domestic scene is not what these extravagant rhetorical flourishes indicated to be. Turkey is coming steadily and every passing year more internationalized, more globalized, more Europeanized, if you like, if you think of those words mean the same. And we should not forget that when there's been a lot of articles in the press about Turkey turning away from the West and becoming a Middle Eastern power and Islamist power. This is really nonsense. You just have to look at the economics of it. Half of Turkey's trade is with Europe and always has been. And that, okay, Turkey has reoriented. It's taking opportunistic advantage of the wealth, the new oil wealth in the Middle East and the opportunities in Russia and the need to expand into Africa. And, of course, that's changing the details of Turkey's trade profile. But still, half is with Europe. And more importantly, I think 90% of foreign investment in Turkey it was in the European Progress Report last year, but for 2008, was 90% of the foreign investment was from the EU. And if you look at the Turkish Airlines schedule, for instance, and look where the planes go, they're all going to Europe, thick black lines of communications with Europe, four planes to Zurich, four planes to Geneva, four planes to Munich, four planes to Stuttgart, all every day. And then you look at what's happening with the Middle East. Well, actually, funnily enough, where do the four planes a day go to in the Middle East? Tel Aviv. Damascus, Jeddah, Riyadh, Tehran, one or two planes a day. It's different. And that's just the THY schedule. Huh? The charter schedule is even more thickly bound with Europe. 3 or 4 million Turks living in Europe. Okay, not fully integrated as Frenchmen or Germans, but as I sometimes put it to my French interlocutors, perhaps we should be a little more sophisticated about how we see the Turks in Europe. A Turkish family living in Lille is quite likely to go and visit their relatives in Amsterdam for the weekend and or then go and see a football match in Cologne and then perhaps go to Brussels to do some business. And they will not think anything about those European boundaries, which is something that average European is unlikely to do, and that perhaps we should think of the Turks, those Turks living in Europe as really pioneering Europeans as opposed to being unintegrated symbols of the past. Of course, that's not a very popular argument with the French, and it's not reflecting the whole reality of the Turkish immigrant community, but I think it's unfair to put them all in one problematic block. Another thing I would just point to institutionally when people talk about Turkey is this potential rogue state and so forth. Turkey took over a UN seat a year ago. As a non-permanent member, elected with a record with the highest number of people, but it was elected from the Western European and Others group. That's where Turkey is. Since it's taken that base, UN diplomats tell us at International Crisis Group that Turkey's played a balanced, constructive, and effective role in that seat. It is, yes, the Prime Minister of Turkey made a quite dramatic gesture during the disturbances in Xinjiang when China was having trouble with the Uyghurs, or the Uyghurs were having trouble with the Chinese. I wasn't there, I don't know. But he said he would take it to the UN Security Council. That was a rhetorical flourish. It didn't happen. Nothing like that happened. Look at actions more than the words, is how I would say to judge it. Okay, so I hope I've now persuaded you of Turkey's European tendency. And now I'm going to come on to the question of Cyprus. Now, for reasons that are what Salman Rushdie would call a PC, P2C2E, a process too complicated to explain, Cyprus managed to get itself into the EU as a divided country with all its problems. And this was something that happened in 2004. All that we need to know about this for the purposes of this discussion is that despite having played a full share in making it a very problematic, difficult to solve thing before 2003, Turkey changed its policy in 2003-2004 and supported the reunification of Cyprus. They supported the UN plan for that, which was also supported by the EU and the US and the international community. The Greek Cypriot side, seeing that it was going to get into the EU anyway, and for a number of other reasons, which we don't need to go into, voted 76% against this reunification plan. The EU, in its infinite wisdom, accepted Cyprus as a full member, and since then, a lot of things have got stuck. Because instead of being a problem external to the European Union, it became an internal problem to the European Union, and we can list a number of things that it now blocks. Omer has stressed to me that I should be clear about what we're talking about. Cyprus is a quite small place of about 1 million people, about 800,000 in the Greek Cypriot side, the Republic of Cyprus, of whom about 150,000, I believe, are foreign residents. And on the north side, there are about 320,000 people. The Turks say there are 21,000 troops of the Turkish army, about 9,000 members of the garrison family. And there are probably 180,000 Turkish Cypriots, of whom 30,000 may have been originally Turkish in the last 30 years. And the rest are what the Greek Cypriot side calls colonists, sent by Turkey to colonize northern Cyprus. I think it's a little bit more. I think originally it was a bit like that. I don't think it's like that anymore. They're more like guest workers now. But the fact is that of the 320 to perhaps 400,000 people in the north, half are of a mainland Turkish background, and a half feel themselves to be Turkish Cypriot. Okay. Now, when Cyprus joined the Union, it joined as a divided island, and the EU really didn't know what to do about this. It had tried to put out a reward for the Turkish Cypriots for their positive vote, and it was called the Direct Trade Regulation. And as soon as the Republic of Cyprus joined the EU, it blocked that Direct Trade Regulation. The EU language refers to the isolation of the Turkish Cypriots because they can't trade directly with the EU because they can't get the right stamps, they can't get the right health inspections, and they are subject to external taxes. So it's very difficult for them. It's a very small economy, but still it's difficult for them. The Greek Cypriot side argues, well, they can trade across the Green Line. That should be good enough for everybody. Why not? They can still get their goods to market. That's not the full side of the story. There's a very good, if anyone wants to follow it up, there's a very good paper on this by the PRIO about the Green Line intra-Cypriot trade. There are a lot of problems resulting from prejudices. You cannot sell Turkish-labeled stuff in the south. There have been problems with shipping things onward from the south. And as a result, there's been a real sense of letdown in the Turkish Cypriot community. We tried to do the right thing, and we're still being punished. The European Union views Cyprus as fully inside the European Union. Its territory is inside the European Union, but it recognizes that there are two administrations, but without recognizing the Turkish Cypriot administration. So they have, the Greek Cypriot side did eventually allow an EU financial package to be released to the Turkish Cypriots, about 259 million euros. That's a lot of money in North Cyprus, and it eventually was able to be committed to all kinds of projects. But aside from that, the Turkish Cypriots did not benefit much from the EU directly. However, they did get, the ones who were real Turkish Cypriots, according to the Greek Cypriot point of view, did get EU passports, Republic of Cyprus passports. About 100,000 of them today have the right to those passports. Now, how this changes the dynamic of Cyprus now is that the Turkish Cypriots, the real Turkish Cypriots, as it were, have the passports, and so they have an escape route if they don't. Then, if they don't want to get passionate about the process that's going on in the reunification process, which I'm about to talk about, they have an alternative. They have a passport to leave. And the huge disappointment of 2004 has made it very difficult to get anybody interested on the Turkish Cypriot side about the process. I think I've run a little bit ahead of myself. Let me just go back to why it's important. Currently, the Cyprus problem is closing down half of the negotiating chapters between Turkey and the EU. If the four that are left to open are very difficult chapters, requiring expensive, deep changes in Turkey for no obvious return for Turkey, and we're talking about very difficult changes to the actual structure of the Turkish government and society. The other 18 or 16 to 18 which are blocked by Cyprus are much easier. And the reason that these chapters are important is that every 6 months, in order to keep the process going, you need to open a chapter symbolically to show the people of Turkey that there's a process going on, that the goal is there, that the game continues. And that can't happen if the Cyprus process is blocked. If anyone cares about cooperation between EU and NATO, that can't happen as long as Cyprus is a member of the EU, Republic of Cyprus is a member of the EU, and Turkey is a member of NATO. They block everything. And that, people exaggerate probably the impact of it, but it's symbolic that in Afghanistan, EU and NATO structures cannot really talk to each other officially. And in the Balkans, too, there are EU-NATO areas which cannot progress properly. I think that the bigger problem of the blockage in Cyprus is that both communities have a sense of unfinished business. The Greek Cypriots have the fact that they've been deprived of their property. Three quarters of the north of the Turkish north side of the island is originally owned by Greek Cypriots, and they have not got any compensation for that, or very few of them have. They have Turkish troops in the middle of their capital. They have the ghost town, a resort called Varosha, which Turkey took as a kind of negotiating chip back in 1974. And that sits there empty with food still in the fridges and legendarily breakfast set on the tables still sitting there since 1974. Cars in garages. And that's not coming back. And above all, there's a sense of insecurity that the kids in the Greek Cypriot side of the island don't really have a really broad future in front of them in an island that is basically living as a gated community or even a ghetto at the far eastern end of Europe. So that is an issue for them. The Turkish Cypriots, obviously, we've talked a bit about their isolation. The Turks have their road to Europe blocked. The Greeks of Greece, they have a problem too in that they have a huge financial crisis, and yet their spending on military affairs is about 5% of their budget, very high by European terms. And the main reason is that they have to keep defending their lines in the sand or in the sea or in the air in the Aegean, which Turkey constantly prods to remind Greece that it's unhappy about the situation. And I'm pretty sure from my contacts in Ankara that until Cyprus is solved, Greece and Turkey cannot solve their Aegean issues. It's the keystone of change there. I think also there's another long-term result of that EU-Turkey friction that results from a failure to solve Cyprus, and that it gives more arguments to those who would present them there being a clash of civilizations, that Muslims and Christians can't come to terms. And I think that a Turkey that is pushed away from Europe, as it is being by the Cyprus problem, is going to be a country that, where it's much easier to make those arguments. So what's happening now? 2 years ago, we had 5 years of real stalemate after the joining of the island to the EU, where nothing much was going on. We had some very sterile discussions between the hardline Greek Cypriot, late Greek Cypriot leader Tassos Papadopoulos and the Turkish Cypriot administration, which had supported the reunification of the island, or a compromised reunification of the island. Then I think that the Greek Cypriot community saw the problem. They saw that time was not on their side. And in very important elections in January 2008, two-thirds of the Greek Cypriots voted for compromise-minded candidates. One of them, the Cypriot communist, Dimitris Christofias, and another from another party who was even more outspoken about the need to compromise. In the end, President Christofias won. Almost immediately, things started happening. There was another definition of how the future reunified Cyprus would look. Since the 1970s, there's been an idea that it will be bicommunal and bizonal. They added the ideas that there would be a single international personality and that there would be two constituent states. Okay, everyone argues about these theoretical terms, but anyway, the point is that they were able to agree on the ideas. More crossing points opened up on the front lines, and I should say that very peaceful front lines on Cyprus. The main difference between the two sides when you cross over, which can be done in about 10 seconds, is that on the south side you have an S-Class Mercedes taxi of 2-year-old vintage, and on the north side it's a 5-year-old vintage S-Class Mercedes. They're quite prosperous and well off by international standards. It's quite a luxurious conflict in some ways. But the point is that there is still this unresolved thing that's still there, and Christofias and Tarat started meeting, and in September 2008 they went into full-scale talks, and it's run by the UN. Very important. The UN has a legitimate facilitating role, but it's changed since the 2004 Annan Plan process. In the Annan Plan, Turkey, in an extraordinary gesture for Turkey, which as we know is a very controlling kind of country, they said, okay, the UN can fill in the blanks. And at the time, the Greek Cypriots agreed to that as a conflict resolution method. And the UN did fill in the blanks and came up with the Annan Plan. The Greek Cypriots rejected it, because they said that the filling in was unfair. So this time round, they decided that the two sides would talk without any filling in by the UN. The UN would just sit there. And they appointed a facilitator, former Foreign Minister of Australia, Alexander Downer, and he has just done that. He's just sat there. And when things weren't happening, in fact, most of the time, he would say, you can't agree on that? All right, I'm off to Australia. I'll be back in 2 weeks. Which was a very interesting tactic, because it's forced both sides to see that no one from outside is going to help them this time. It's up to them. And it's especially has had the interesting effect that Alexander Downer is still viewed as a legitimate facilitator. He has not been attacked by anyone, because there's been nothing really to attack. He's not tried to make peace or anything dangerous like that. And the process got into a series of... I don't think you need to really go into the details of it, but there were six main chapters and one extra chapter about government, economy, EU relations, dealing with the population issues, which was code for the settlers, and other areas of the discussions. The most difficult one, which they started on, was the governance and the governance and power sharing. The Greek Cypriots very early on made some very interesting concessions. They said the 50,000 Turkish settlers or immigrants could stay, and they also said we will have a rotating presidency, which is a big concession. I mean, it's 80% Greek Cypriot, remember this island. They said there can be a Turkish Cypriot by law ruling on a rotating basis. And in return, very recently only, there's been a concession from the Turkish side. They said, okay, we'll agree to the Greek Cypriot idea that there should be cross-voting, so that each community has a small say in who gets elected on the other side, but they will still elect these two figures separately. During these talks, I think that the two people who are doing the negotiations for the two communities, the two presidents, on one side Christofias, the other side Mehmet Ali Talat, have a very good understanding of each other. They are old friends. They have a very similar left-wing ideology. They're quite suspicious of each other now because there's been unhappiness. But I feel that despite all those understandings and the quite significant areas of agreement, the negotiations never moved past first base. And I would say that it took me a long time to realize this. If you can believe it, I wrote 3 long reports on Cyprus in the last 2 years. And the arguments are so blindingly obvious that all sides win from an agreement and everyone loses significantly economically and for security reasons from a failure to agree. It seemed to me that these arguments must win. But it wasn't happening. People were not convinced. There's very little excitement about these talks on the island. No one actually sells the idea that there is a great dawn for Cyprus coming. Great cynicism. And I kept wondering what this was about. And I gradually, because all the Greek Cypriots I would speak to individually understood how much they needed normalization with Turkey, and all the Turkish officials I would speak to when the sort of positions had been set out and set aside would also understand the need for solving the problem. In fact, as one of the very few people who actually goes to talk to both sides, I'm convinced that if you blindfolded both sides, you would come, they would and ask them, what can you live with really? They would actually have a quite similar set of what they could live with, which is actually roughly what we have today, frankly. I mean, it's not an unhappy island in general. But when it comes to the big questions, when it comes to the jointly expressed questions, the communal policies, especially the Greek Cypriots, have a sense of terror, I would put it, of Turkey. They are so frightened of Turkey that when it comes to a communal decision to come to terms, they lock together like and roll out the quills like a hedgehog, or they go into their shells like tortoises. They don't want to discuss because they don't believe that Turkey is serious about implementing an agreement and withdrawing the troops and being sincere in wanting to come to terms. And it's the same thing in Ankara. They do not believe that the Greek Cypriots are ready to come to terms on any level that is acceptable to Turkey. And I'm sure I was not the only one who was telling both sides, look, you have this problem. I believe you that you want this agreement, but you know the other side doesn't believe that you want it. And I know that embassies were saying the same thing. I'm sure the UN was saying the same thing. And eventually, I think that between all of us, we got to the situation where finally the Turkish Prime Minister invited a group of Greek Cypriots to Turkey to meet him. And I was lucky enough to be invited to watch this, and it was extraordinary. The Prime Minister sat down in his grand reception chamber next to the Dolmabahçe Palace in Istanbul and immediately said, I want you to know that I want a deal. I want to implement that deal. And if we have a deal on the island, I will withdraw the troops. And the Greek Cypriots were looking at him open-eyed. One by one, they stood up and asked questions in a pretty moderate manner, given the history of the conflict, and an empathetic manner. The Turkish Prime Minister relaxed, and he stayed an extra half hour, mingled with them, and it was quite clear that Indeed, the real problem is a huge, monumental lack of communication between the two sides. Because, you know, when I sat in the bus going away afterwards, the Greek Cypriots were saying to each other, you know, he really meant that, didn't he? Yes. This is a breakthrough. This is historic. This is extraordinary. Turkey had been saying that since 2004, but they hadn't been saying it directly. And that's still not happening directly. However, this was a breakthrough. And there have been a number of other rays of hope. For instance, the Greek Cypriot Archbishop, who has for years been the most convinced opponent of any concessions to the Turkish side, wrote a letter to the Turkish Prime Minister asking if he could go and visit a monastery in the northern side. Something must have happened. There must have been some communication. He went, accompanied by a Turkish Cypriot official, and he didn't say anything horrible. In fact, it all went quite well. We've seen the Greek Cypriot side also expressing the idea of agreeing to a multilateral forum, which would include Turkish Cypriots, Greece, Turkey, and the Greek Cypriots, in some format. That the format is still not decided. This is what needs to happen next. There has to be a meeting in which all the principal parties of this dispute meet and talk, and that there is a long-lived process. Turkey has to convince the Greek Cypriots directly at a leadership level and as state bureaucracies that they are not aiming for an independent Turkish Republic in North Cyprus, but they really want to help the Turkish Cypriots get into the EU with their full rights and with a mutually agreed framework. But that can only be done by the president or prime minister of Turkey, I'm convinced. And the Greek Cypriot side have to be ready to believe that this is not a gambit for the legitimization of the independence of the Turkish Republic of North Cyprus, which is not going to happen. And I think that the Greek Cypriot side is seeing that the wall is coming closer, because if there's an election this month in the Turkish Republic of North Cyprus, which is focusing a lot of minds and is also actually holding up the process a bit at the moment, in which the Turkish Cypriot leader, who's done so much to support the peace process, may lose his job just because the Turkish Cypriots and the inhabitants of the north are just bored and fed up. And it's a very dangerous moment because, of course, if he is kicked out as the proponent of compromise settlement, that will be a signal to people that, hang on, who is really pushing for a solution here? Because Turkey has done a lot to try and make this solution happen, and this will damage the image of that. And I think that if there can be a multilateral process involving everybody that's going on soon, that will make any change of government in the Turkish Cypriot less damaging. Because if this doesn't happen, everyone will lose. I cannot see the UN trying to get a fifth round of talks going, a fifth major round on a bicommunal, bizonal settlement which no one can agree on. I mean, why should anyone do that? The Greek Cypriots, as I said, will keep the Turkish troops will remain. They will not get the territory back, but 8% of the island is on the table from the Turkish side. They will not get easy compensation for their lost land, and they will carry on being, as I said, this ghetto and isolated community on the eastern end of Europe. Plus, they should remember that they've had 5 years where they've been making a big fuss in all councils in Europe, and the Europeans that I speak to are increasingly frustrated and fed up with this one-issue country. That is going to be difficult for them to sustain. They're going to become isolated in Europe. The Turkish Cypriots will be scattered to the four winds. Already they're only half of the population of the north, the other half being people from Turkey. I think they're going to use those European passports to go elsewhere, as the dynamic, which I think is going to be become dominant, is that the Turkish North Cyprus, already very heavily part of Turkey, will become even more part of Turkey. And Turkey is not going to tolerate the extraordinarily spendthrift ways of the Turkish Cypriot government. They spend a billion lira, which is about $800 million there every year. I think that Turkey's going, if this process goes into the long grass, Turkey's going to tighten the screws on that, and it's going to demand some good governance on the Turkish Cypriot side. Currently, they're about half as rich as the mainland Turks, and I think that proportion will decrease. But above all, from my perspective, as someone covering Turkey and Europe, if there is no solution, then the EU Turkey process goes from the fridge into the freeze, and I don't think anyone will know how to get it out.
Great. Thank you, Hugh. Excellent presentation, with very comprehensive with the background as well. I'm sure there will be lots of questions, and we'll open up for the Q&A very soon. But let me ask you a technical question. When the Republic of Cyprus became a member of the European Union with this large wave of enlargement to Eastern Europe, Central Europe, Turkey signed the additional protocol of Ankara to the customs union and at least, in my knowledge, committed itself to open its ports and airports to Greek Cypriot products. And that basically has not happened. Turkey is reluctant to open its ports and airports to Greek Cypriot products, and that gives ammunition to the Greek Cypriot government, the Republic of Cyprus, for blocking the aid to the mm-hmm. Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus. So if we are to understand their narrative, they're saying, look, there's a country, we are in the EU now, this is a club, and Turkey is not even acknowledging our existence. We forget about recognition. It's not even opening its ports and airports to our products. So they have this narrative of basically Turkey should comply also with its international obligations. In that sense, there is this Greek Cypriot side to this story, and I guess part of the reason why they're unable to trust Turkey is that there's this perception that Turkey is not committing itself fully to this process, and they keep asking why Turkey needs to have 35 to 40,000 troops on the island. Wouldn't it be a nice gesture from Turkey to unilaterally withdraw a few thousands of troops at least to gain that moral high ground on this issue? And this is not happening as well, despite the fact that Turkish foreign policy appears to be very self-confident, with Davutoğlu now having this vision of Turkey as a regional superpower. Turkey is not acting as a country that seems to really have confidence enough to withdraw a few thousand troops from Cyprus. So could we address these two issues, and then we'll open up to Q&A?
I think right now it's important to keep the focus on the talks, the UN facilitated talks. I think that unilateral confidence building measures is not the time, that's not the way to break through. That will, in fact, I think, draw attention to the troops. I mean, we at Crisis Group, being quite pragmatic, some reports we say, yes, this is the time to do a symbolic withdrawal, and other times we say, we don't mention it. I mean, of course, it would be good to withdraw troops, but would now be the time to play that card? Right now, it's very difficult. We don't know what's going to happen on the 18th when we have these elections. I think that doing anything before then is going to be difficult. But as soon as the elections are over, Turkey has to capture the Greek Cypriot imagination somehow. Is it by guided visits to Varosha for previous owners? Is it meeting Greek Cypriot politicians? Is it... I believe the Greek Cypriot Archbishop is coming to Istanbul. Is there a potential for doing something there? But having seen that meeting between Greek Cypriot civil society and the Turkish leaders and seeing what a huge impact it has to have direct communication about what the two sides really want, and knowing that individually Greek Cypriots are fully convinced that normalization with Turkey is in their economic and social and security interests, I think that these talks have to be made to work. I think fiddling of the details is not the moment. And I think that the Greek Cypriots really need to be aware that the Turkish side, as far as I understand it, is ready to withdraw troops according to the schedule that they will agree much faster than that very long and unsettling. I mean, it was a very long process in the Anantan. I mean, it was what they agreed on those days, so that was it. But it was 12 years or something before they got down to those minimal garrisons from the previous mm-hmm. era. And I think that once the Greek Cypriot government is convinced that the Turkish government will really withdraw all the troops, because that's what they care about, or down to the last 650, or whatever it is they agree, and that Turkey will agree on some new treaty of guarantee. And again, Turkey's not saying what it will do publicly, because it's such an important card in their hand. But if anyone looks at our last report called Cyprus in September the 30th, it came out, we have a proposal for how you could change the Treaty of Guarantee, change its name for start, security and implementation. break it down. Some bits would be done locally, some remedies would be local, some would be EU, some would be UN, and perhaps as a last resort, you could have a line saying that if the Greek Cypriot side attacks the Turkish Cypriot side, then Turkey has a right to defend the Turkish Cypriot side. That is the bottom line that Turkey needs to be able to show its public opinion, and Turkish Cypriots want that, by the way. But it's no longer the 1960 Treaty of Guarantee. But of course, and we wrote that. I've never seen a criticism of that by Turkish officials. Now, but the Greek Cypriot side, because they don't hear the Turkish side, they don't understand that there is that flexibility there at the end of the day. And that's what light at the end of the tunnel is there, but neither side can see it. And that's the tragedy of what's been happening.
And, trade with Cyprus, opening Turkish ports and airports?
Well, there's a lot of interesting rumors that perhaps there will be the Lisbon Treaty arrangements in Europe, because it's a trade issue, it could come up for qualified majority voting in Europe, and therefore that 2004 direct trade regulation might come up again and be passed. Of course, the Republic of Cyprus is trying to block that, which I think it would be most unfortunate. I think Republic of Cyprus should seize this opportunity to find a way, as you said, to open the ports. And that would be a good step to normalization, which would allow both sides to start meeting each other formally and officially. And I would point to what happened between Turkey and Armenia. Now, the nationalists on both sides have now got a hold of this process, but I would point to last year, after only 8 years of getting to know each other, the Turkish and Armenian governments signed two sets of protocols on opening the borders and establishing diplomatic relations, opening their border. Excellently balanced protocols. The solid middle ground of both countries was behind that. And that was the result of the two sides meeting and talking over a period of years and winning each other's confidence. I think in 2000, if you'd said that there were such protocols would be signed in 2008, you would have been sort of given 10-1 odds. But it can happen. And what's mad about it is these two countries, the Greek Cypriots and the Turks, are so close to each other, and yet they know each other so little.
Great. Let me remind our audience that Hugh is coming up with an international crisis report on Turkey and the Middle East in the next week or
next
so.
Next 10 days or so.
So, okay, Nevzat. One question. Could you identify yourself, please?
I'm Nevzat Stacey, president of Hasna Incorporated. We do work in Cyprus and southeastern Turkey. About a month ago, I was at Georgetown University. I had the pleasure of hearing the ambassador from Cyprus talk about the island. He made a statement, of course, saying that the troops in the north should leave the island, but his ultimate goal was a demilitarized island. Yet he never mentioned the British bases. And I don't see any writing about those either anywhere. Could you comment on that, please?
As a Brit.
Yeah. Well, a lot of historical writing about the origins of the Cyprus conflict, some people believe that it was all a British plot to try and divide and rule and keep the bases. And some people say the same thing about the Annan Plan process, was who won there? The British bases got into the European Union officially. Still, they're an interesting issue because actually it's the one issue that unites both the Turkish Cypriots and Greek Cypriots. They both want those bases out. And
so much for British imperialism.
Well, I think the British are only keeping them on for the Americans. I don't think Britain needs them. But I think even in the 70s, Britain was trying to close them down, but realized that they were one of the key things they brought to the alliance. So, the interesting thing that Britain has done is to say, look, if you two or you five or how many people are going to agree on the Cyprus settlement, then we will give back half of the base area. Now, the base area is about 3% of the island of Cyprus, and they're going to give 1.5% back. And, of course, everyone will then have to decide who takes it. And our position is, look, what about our suggestion is, why not have some jointly run national parks, the Karpas Peninsula, there's another one in the south, and then maybe this new land from the British base areas could all be federally run areas. And that's You know, but that's such a detail. The key thing is learning to trust each other. That's what needs to happen.
Thank you. I'm Arsen Kharotyan from Voice of America Armenian Service. Thank you for the presentation, first of all. Well, just about 4 months ago, 5 months ago, November the 1st, across the street at the School of Advanced International Studies, Turkish Prime Minister Mr. Erdogan announced that don't expect Turkish troops to be withdrawn from the Cyprus during this year or anytime soon. So from one side, there is direct talks where there seems to be some confidence that there can be some progress on the withdrawal. From the other side, we hear a lot of rhetoric from Washington, which talks the opposite. Also about the Armenian-Turkish relationship, seems like the protocols are going in nowhere, and we're at the edge of going to a major disaster diplomatically, because I do believe that it was a major progress on both sides, but it seems like it's going backwards. So this inconsistency of the Turkish foreign politics, which is zero problems with the neighbors, seems to be actually creating gaps in the communication. And I would be happy if you would comment on this. Thank you.
I think you're very modest in saying that's a gap in communication. But you're right. I mean, these are two issues that are the most important things for Turkey. The relations with the Organization of the Islamic Conference are interesting, but that's not core. The relationship with Cyprus governs the relationship with the European Union. The fixing the Armenian question is the key to good relations between Turkey and the United States. And also, the people involved are much closer, and it's much more important to solve those ones than all the exciting facilitation efforts around the region that Turkey is pursuing. And yes, there are contradictory messages coming out. I think Cyprus is a little more time sensitive in some ways. Up until last month, I thought that actually. But now the Armenian question is coming back with a vengeance. But the contradictory messages are a problem, and it makes it difficult to explain to people what the underlying thrust of Turkish policy is. And I would just say that I think that the protocols signed by the two sides are being defended as much as is humanly possible by the bureaucracy in Ankara. They can see that this is the best thing they managed to get for many years. It's a way forward on the question of the genocide. It's a way forward on proving, giving a signal to the Cypriots are watching the Armenian question like hawks. If they see Turkey backing away from a deal on Armenia, they think, uh-oh. Now, we're listening to them. They're saying they're going to do a deal with us. They're promising they'll implement it. But what happened to those protocols? So, yeah, it's really important to keep them on course. There's a lot of politics involved. But on the Armenian question, the important thing to remember is that the moderate center backs those protocols, and that the letting those protocols go is giving in to nationalists both in Turkey and in Azerbaijan and in the Armenian diaspora and in Armenia. It hands the question back to the radicals and makes it all much more complicated and difficult to solve, and to solve the real problems of ordinary people in Armenia. You know, they need to trade with Turkey. They need to work in Turkey with proper rights and not be threatened and so forth. And similarly, on Cyprus, what Cyprus needs to get its economy is okay on the south, but look at what happened when Turkey and Greece normalized. Huge boom in trade and investment. And studies show that within 7 years on Cyprus after a solution, Cyprus would add 10 percentage points to its national output within 7 years at a minimum, just if they follow the pattern that was established with Greece and Turkey. So I think politicians should keep their eye on the fruits of it and not give in to all these nationalist reflexes. But, of course, I'm a conflict resolution NGO speaking. I would say that, but I really believe it too.
Thank you so much for giving this talk. I'm Sarah Dunn. I'm a student at McDaniel College. And I have a question about the extreme nationalism on both sides in Cyprus, kind of the historic nationalism and trying to move away from that. And I see beyond the more concrete political issues that the identity issue of the Cypriot people has been a major factor in the conflict. And I was wondering if you see kind of a goal, as Talat had once said, of having a Cypriot national identity, if that goal is too far gone now, or if it's still kind of a hope in order to reunite the island.
That could be a goal, but it would be wrong to use that creation of a Cypriot identity as a way of excluding other factors. The Cyprus problem is incredibly complex. There are at least seven parties involved, one way or another. And of course, the Greek Cypriot community, being 80%, 20% with the Turkish Cypriot community, wants to have just to draw a line around Cyprus and keep it all as just those two parties. But that's not going to, that doesn't fly. I mean, 1974. Why did the 1974 invasion happen? Because Greece did a coup to annex the island. Greece has a historic involvement. The British bases we've talked about, they're there. The UN has a role as the facilitator. And you can't solve it without reference to these powerful outsiders who have interests. And it's an idea. You know, I'm sure that President Christofias hasn't both the pragmatic thing, let's keep it amongst ourselves, and maybe has an idealistic memory of identity politics from his where he studied and everything. And but that is... It would be naive to think that you can exclude everyone else from the talks, especially when there are agreed treaties. I mean, these 1960 treaties are international treaties. You can't just sort of ignore them.
Thank you. Mustafa Tunç from TRNC Washington office. My question would be inspired by an article that I have recently read on the Wall Street Journal. The article was suggesting that the postponement of Turkey's membership to the European Union is not actually affected by the Cyprus problem, but rather affected by the fact that the country is overwhelmingly Muslim, 99%. And having you said that this was a fact that is being used by European politicians, can we conclude that Cyprus is being a secondary factor rather than being a primary factor in Turkey's membership process?
That's a very good question. It's a chicken and the egg thing. And is Cyprus the cause or the result of all these problems? Who is hiding behind the Cyprus dispute? Who in the 1980s and 1990s was hiding behind Greece when Greece was playing the same role in pushing Turkey away? I would urge you just to look at the politics of it. As I try and point out in my book, Dining with Al-Qaeda, looking at Islam as an analytical tool leads you into error, because it is not Islam is a religion. It's not an objective thing that can be universally applied and to understanding. And I think that if Turkey had a GNP per capita income of $40,000 a year, we wouldn't hear any of this Muslim stuff. And if the Europe got in a fight with Russia about something big, and suddenly Europe needed Turkey again, just like it needed Turkey in the Cold War, and as the former president, Süleyman Demirel, used to say, during the Cold War, they never called us Muslims. Yeah. You know, it's an excuse not to do something. It's also based in real fears in Europe. I'm not denying that those fears are real, but I mean, they're not based on reality. They're based on a misunderstanding of what Turkey really is.
The back.
Thank you, Mr. Pope. Nick Larigakis with the American Hellenic Institute. It is also important to note, of course, that on August 14th of 1974, when the second and more brutal invasion took place, which solidified the division of the island as we know it today, after the legitimate government of Cyprus was restored within a week after the right-wing coup from Athens and with that of Mr. Nicholas Sampson. But be it as it may, Washington doesn't like history too much. Let's talk about contemporary times. And regarding these negotiations, it is argued that the process should be one of ownership of the Cypriots for the Cypriots. I would think you would agree for that. However, it's also been said that in relating to how Turkey needs to be supportive of the entire process. And you've alluded in your comments that you feel strongly that the Turkey has a given positive nature towards the whole process. But it's been